around to talk about it himself.
That's okay. He I mean, he just did the edit, right, at our...
Yes, that's correct. Exactly right, Marilyn.
Jordan, I just need to announce that I can only be on the call for an hour. My apologies, but I will have to leave early.
Okay. Well, I will try to... I'm hoping we won't be too much longer than that in any case.
Hey.
Hi, Jordan. I just joined. It's Tom Pello.
Hi, Tom.
Jordan, before we start, have we managed to make some kind of assessment of whether the new timing for the weekly conference call is convenient for a majority of people? Because I think we used to hold them 3 hours earlier in the day, and the idea was basically to accommodate people calling in from Australia, East Asia, and so on. And I don't know to what extent we have managed with the new timing to really welcome new participants. So, I mean, from a personal point based in Brussels, I personally wouldn't mind going back to the original. But maybe that wouldn't work for other people. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, Nicholas, let me just actually propose an agenda briefly. Glenn already had a couple of several items in the invitation, but I think there's a couple other items I'd like to discuss administratively before we get to the substance. But I think actually we had, for completely different reasons, Nicholas, I'd wanted to bring the timing of the calls up in any case. So briefly, as an agenda, I'd like to propose first that we talk about just a brief update from Maria on the preliminary report on the notification work item. Secondly, to talk about the two administrative matters. One, just to briefly recap the Jeff's resignation as co-chair and see if we want to do anything about that, replace him perhaps, or continue to operate with a single, I guess now, chair at this point, and then talk about the timing of calls, and then third, move to the substance of the discussion about the procedure that Steve sent earlier this week. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to add to the agenda?
I can't think of anything right now.
Okay, thanks, Marilyn. If that's the case, then Maria, can you just give us a quick update on the preliminary report? I know you did get it posted last Friday, and just talk us through the process from here on out.
Sure. Well, the report has gone up on the ICANN website. Now, it's linked to, it's in a slightly deep part of the website, so we're also working on getting a link to it from the front page to make it more accessible to people who haven't been involved in the process all along. In terms of process, where it goes from here, it will have 20 days of consultation. And what we did was we started the 20 days from Saturday last, so that there were 20 full days of consultation. And then from that point, we have to bring all of the comments together and then bring them.
Tony Harris.
After we've received the public comments, then we put them together and we deliver it all to the GNSO Council.
Okay.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, go. Look, I have a very technical one, Marilyn, and I'll turn it over to you. Maria, what's the date that the public comment is scheduled to end right now?
Let me think. I think it was around
12th of May.
12th of May. 12th of
okay.
May, yep.
Thanks. Okay, go ahead, Marilyn. Does anyone else want to be in the queue to ask Maria questions about this? Okay, go ahead, Marilyn.
A two-part question. One is a clarification on the 20 days. I don't think we do specify in the PDP that it's working days, Maria, but is that what you guys tried to accomplish, is to make it what would be considered non-ICANN working days?
And we've actually just counted days full stop, because that's what has been done in the past. But if nobody has any objections, and if people would prefer, we can certainly make it working days.
I just am asking for clarification, just so that we all know. So right now, it's just 20 days, and that would be, so we've got roughly, 12, something like 15 or so days left to go?
Yeah, we should have about I suppose 17 by now. I mean, PDP is a bit odd in this regard. It just counts. It just says days rather than working days. I thought it was a bit odd myself.
It's entirely my fault. I was on that group. I want to go to my next question. If we could just go back and help many of us who, you know, we're not that familiar necessarily with the PDP. So you take the comments, and what do you summarize the, you summarize the comments, you append them, or do you come back to the task force and tell the task force, here's what the comments say? And I think we've, you know, we just need to kind of have clear in our mind, all of us, what the process is. Do you just summarize them and then append them to the report, and then that's what goes to council?
As far as I understand, yeah. I mean, the PDP says that the staff manager will review the comments received and add those deemed appropriate. Prepare the final report and submit it to the council. What I would have envisaged would be to summarize the comments, all of the comments received, you know, basically just simply editing them for readability and putting them into a report that goes to the council.
Yeah, Jordan, I'm gonna make a suggestion as somebody who's been around for a very long time for everybody to consider. When we wrote the PDP, it was not a perfect animal, and a lot of the input that was provided was not accepted by the chair and the staff who were trying to do their best to get a streamlined process. Maybe it would make sense to try to help to have a call after the comments are all received and to have the final report from the staff reviewed by the task force. And at least by the chair of the task force.
Yeah, no, I was actually going to suggest something very much along those lines, Marilyn, which is, and I think we discussed this on our previous call, was to have a call relating to this topic shortly after the close of the public comment period.
Right.
On the 17th of May. And the intent there would be, one thing that we did not do in our last meeting when we voted is one of the goals of the PDP that is to try to get to consensus, and obviously to be able to adapt the recommendations to any public comments we receive, although that's not clear from the PDP, it seems like it would be useful. So I do think that it would be productive for us, and we did this in Task Force 2 at least, is to revisit the substance of the report after we've seen the public comments to see if there's any tweaks that may be appropriate in light of the public comments, and I would suggest that we do that. With that in mind, I think it will require a pretty quick turnaround, Maria, on the staff's part, in order to give us time to do that. So, do you think it would be reasonable to say by the end of by that Monday the 16th to have the final what the sort of your proposed final report to the task force for us to review?
Sure, I'm thinking the end of comments is a Thursday. Yes.
Hi, it's Brett.
I think that's certainly reasonable, Jordan, and I'll absolutely prioritize it. Yep.
Okay. Thanks, Maria. So we will schedule that now. Is that the 17th? We will have a discussion around what the whether we want to make any adjustments to the recommendations or other elements of the report in light of the public comments that we've received during that period.
And Jordan, just to straightforward a little bit, I don't have in front of me, but Glenn probably does. Glenn, can you give us the dates on the council meeting so the task force has those in mind as well?
Yes, certainly, Marilyn. Just 1 minute. The next council meeting is on the 12th of May, and then there is a council meeting scheduled on the 2nd of June and one on the 23rd of June. And then in the second week of July, we will have the ICANN meeting in Luxembourg.
So those meetings are scheduled, you know, not really taking this into account. Do we have any kind of deadline by which we need to get the report, the final report, into the council for consideration? I'm thinking we don't.
Yeah, I don't believe that there is one, but it seems like we should target, I mean, that 2nd of June meeting seems like a reasonable target given the, unless it turns out the public comments require significant revisions on behalf of the task force.
We should go ahead, Jordan. Not everybody knows this, but there is actually a rule about how many, you have to get the request for the agenda in so many days ahead on the council meeting.
Yeah, that's correct. And what's the intake rule is 14 days, I believe?
Yeah. Okay. You could even send it now as a tentative request.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, any other questions or comments about the preliminary report for the notification work item? Okay, moving on then to two administrative items, the first of which is Jeff Newman's resignation as co-chair, which I'm sure you all noted on the list. I'm personally very disappointed to see Jeff taken away by other opportunities at NuStar, although it sounds like they're exciting ones for him. And I guess the question is, does the task force see a need to elect another co-chair, or do we proceed at least until we have new terms of reference and or new instructions from the council with just a single chair at this point?
Could I ask you a question?
Sure, certainly.
Given that we are in the process of concluding some work, would you be willing to continue as the chair rather than are going through the process of recruiting and electing?
I would be at least until we see what the scope of the new terms of reference are.
Yeah.
And it's difficult, you know, given that we may be sort of in winding down mode or we may see a lot of additional work there.
Yeah.
It's difficult to anticipate what my reaction might be after we've seen that.
Sure.
But I would say certainly for the next few weeks until we see a new charter, I'd be happy to do that.
My proposal would be that we move forward in that way duration at the point that you indicate to us, if you feel that's indicated.
Okay, that's fine. Anyone else have thoughts on this?
I second Marilyn's proposal, Tony Harris.
Thanks, Tony. Okay, so we will proceed with me acting as chair, I suppose, until such time as I beg for mercy and request some additional assistance from a co-chair being elected. It has been very helpful in the past, just given the frequency of meetings that this task force has had, to have the co-chair arrangement, and we may find that it's needed in the future, but I will soldier on at least for the next few weeks in this chair capacity. So this, the other administrative work item then is to talk about the time slot for the call. We did previously meet 3 hours earlier than this, in order, which was a reasonably good slot for most people, I believe. We did make the adjustment, which was intended to live at least through Mar del Plata in order to accommodate Bruce Tonkin and other Asia Pacific members' representation. And Nicholas has asked the question whether that's still useful. This current slot is actually not at all useful for that purpose at this point in time because of the shift in daylight savings. At least it's not for Bruce. I believe it's now 4 in the morning in Australia. Bruce...
Japan as well, Jordan.
Pardon?
It's the middle of the night, Japan.
Too. Yeah, so this slot is actually during the summer season here in the Northern Hemisphere is not very useful for its stated goal. So we have a couple of alternatives that have been proposed off list. One, Bruce is, I think, still interested in participating, and he suggested that in order to broaden participation, we might have alternating time slots, alternating between, I believe it would be this time slot and the in an 8 a.m. Eastern time slot. Is that right, Glenn?
That's right, Jordan.
Alternatively, I think the impression I get is that this time slot may actually be less preferable than the previous time slot we have, the 11 a.m. Eastern slot, which we had previously. And similarly, if we wanted to alternate, we could alternate between that and an 8 a.m. Eastern time slot, or we could just settle on one slot that we think works for the vast majority of the members.
Jordan,
I'm open to comments on this and from the...
Yeah, Jordan, it's Ken Stubbs.
Yeah, sure, go ahead, Ken. Let me set up a brief cue. Does anyone else want to speak to this?
I do. It's Marilyn.
Paul
Stahura.
Paul.
And Wendy.
Wendy.
And me too, please.
Is that Ross?
It is.
Okay, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, when I chaired the Names Council, we found that 8 in the morning was entirely too early because we do have precipitation. We did in the council, and I know Paul Stahura is located on the West Coast. 8 in the morning forces people on the West Coast to get up at like 4 to 4:30 in order to be able to make a conference call. 9 in the morning or 9:30 worked pretty well for the West Coast people. Granted, was a clock for morning, but that's a lot better than 4 in the morning. Also, 9 in the morning provides adequate time for people on the Pacific Rim. It is in the middle part of the evening, but not the late night, you know. So I would propose that 8 in the morning is too early, and that it should either be 9 or 9:30.
Thanks, Ken. Marilyn?
Let me just do this real quick. I really advise against alternating times. People get confused, and I have not found that to work effectively. I also find it just easier if we're going to have a weekly call to have it at, you know, the same time. And that would be my strong preference. Pick a time that's agreeable to people and stick with it. But I support the need to change the time.
Okay. Thanks, Marilyn. Paul, I bet you're going to say it's too early to wake up at 5 in the morning.
How'd you guess? I do agree with Marilyn. Times is confusing. I was confused when we combined the groups and we had the other calls with the experts, and they were at different times and so on. So I support one time. I'm, you know, 8 a.m. Pacific time is fine, or 9 according to 10. 8 or 9 is good. Also, whatever the time is, I would like a notice be sent to the list, like a day or two in advance, just reminds everybody what the time is, even if it is the same time every week, and what the call-in information is. It seems like at least once a week we'll have somebody sending a mail saying, I don't know what time the meeting's at, or I don't know the call-in information.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, Glenn does send out invitations now, but maybe, Glenn, it would be useful to copy the dial-in information to the mailing list as well when you do send out the invitations.
Okay, I'll remind people.
Okay, go ahead, Wendy.
Sure, just speaking for this West Coaster, earlier is better, but in the morning is a little too early. I would also suggest that anything we can do to make the call shorter and less frequent would be much appreciated, I'm sure, by everyone on board. Thanks.
Thanks, Wendy. And Ross.
Yeah, I'll pass, Jordan. Nobody said anything everybody said what I was going to say anyway.
Okay, so just looking briefly at the wonderful timeanddate.com site, the only time I see it that seems like has the potential to make a broad cross-check spectrum either easy, relatively happy might be something like Ken suggested, maybe 9:30 a.m. Eastern time, which is 3:30 in Central Europe, 6:30 a.m. on the West Coast and 11:30 p.m. In Australia, which is late, but
11:30.
Yeah, 11:30, which is late, but not any worse than what we're proposing the West Coasters have to wake up for, I guess, would be my view.
I'm sorry, I'm back, Jordan. And I really, although Bruce is observing in his role as council chair, this is a task. So while we are being accommodating to our chair, and I support that, maybe that would still be acceptable to him because he is participating with us in an observing role.
Yeah. So let me just ask, does that 9:30 a.m. Eastern slot, does that seem reasonable to people?
It is, Jordan, as you know, it's in the heart of, I don't know, Steve is not on, and neither is David. That is in the heart of business time for all of the people on the East Coast.
It's pretty early for people on the West Coast. I have a number of people on the West Coast, including ICANN.
Fine for me.
It is? Okay.
This is David. Jordan. It's fine for me.
Jordan, it's Ken Stubbs. Can I make one more comment?
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah. I think we also need to consider the fact that for significant periods of time, especially during the daylight savings, I mean, during the regular standard time, we've been holding calls in the middle part of the afternoon, which has put a burden on anybody in Europe. And I've noticed, and I actually commented to Bruce recently, that participation from Europe, is, let's say in the Names Council, is a perfect example of that, appears to be off over the last 6 months because people in Europe are being forced literally every time there's a call, either a task force call in the middle of the afternoon or a Names Council call, to have to take the call at hours ranging from starting at 8 o'clock and going up to sometimes 10, 11 at night. So as much as Europe's been inconvenienced by missing a prime part of their evening, it would seem to me that we could balance it out by maybe half the year doing it in one format and half the year doing it in another format. I'm just trying to offer perspective there.
Okay. We're getting a little bogged down in this, and I do want to move on to substance. What I'm going to propose, actually, is to I'm going to pull the list on two particular times, the 9:30 a.m. Eastern time slot and the 11 a.m. Eastern time slot, and ask people to indicate which they prefer and which they, if there's either of the slots they can't make, and try to make a judgment call based on that.
Hi, Jordan. This is David Fess. I'm sorry for joining.
Okay. Thanks, David. Okay. Any other comments on this, or are we ready to move on? Okay, thanks everyone. We're now gonna move to the, and David, I think when you came, you brought a lot of, background noise with you. Is it possible to mute your connection?
Yeah, do I do star six? Is that what it is?
Is that right, Glenn?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Great, okay. So we're moving on now to the, substance of our conversation today, half an hour into the call. And we're going to be talking today about Steve's proposal for, or the task force's proposal drafted with some changes drafted by Steve as to the proposed procedure for resolving conflicts between national and local law, privacy law, and the who is requirements. I'd like to divide this conversation. I know we've had quite a bit of dialogue on the list, but I'd like to divide this conversation into two halves, putting, first of all, just a discussion of the proposal itself on specifically Steve's proposed edits and whether there are other improvements that we can make to the proposal. And secondly, and this will seem a little strange, but just in terms of the interest of time, I'd like to arrange it this way. Secondly, discussion of the merits of having this recommendation move forward at all, and the value of it relative to other approaches and the various other issues that that Ross and others have been raising on the mailing list. So, so with that in mind, there have been some recommendations made in terms of tweaks and or questions that people might like to address to staff with regards to the modifications that Steve has made. I think Milton and Kathy both have comments along those lines, and some of Brett's comments may relate as well, and certainly I'd open the sort of floor up to anyone interested in commenting along those lines.
Jordan, Paul here.
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, before we start the discussion, you will see, you will have seen that Maria has sent around a little diagram, to which I think it is useful we provide a bit of clarification. We have been looking at this to see exactly who is involved in the sort of scheme which is put up and on what issue. And you will see in the diagram a sort of trajectory going from left to right where there is EDP processes and all the rest, which results basically in ICANN staff subsequently implementing an RIA together with in a relationship with the registrars. Subsequently, the registrars taking the RIA and doing their internal translation and how that results in their contracts with the registrants. And then you get the question, well, suppose that there is an issue. On which is it actually the issue? The paper currently says that we are looking at possible, let me take the text, ongoing conflicts or a risk of conflict between the registrar or registry's legal obligations and the local privacy laws and the contractual obligation to ICANN. And then there is the detail of there are presumptions that there would be possible court cases or actions from government agencies or something like that. Now, in looking at that, we get the impression, maybe I'm wrong, but this is why I think we're seeking some clarification through this diagram. Our impression is that if there are possible actions of government agencies or of courts, they're going to be focused on the relationship between the registrar, if we focus on the registrar for a moment, and the registrar and the registrants. And they are probably the result of, for example, registrants taking things to court and saying, you know, these agreements don't work. We get the impression that any governmental action will not necessarily be directed directly to the RIA between ICANN and the registrar, but much more to the relation between the registrar and the registrant. And obviously the question then arises, is and let's simplify the discussion, is suppose that there is a court case, that's a simple assumption. If the court looks at the relationship in the contractual relationship between the registrar and the registrant and the issues there, I think it is maybe a step too early to say, well, this is a direct result of the RIA. First of all, it isn't clear that the court would actually express itself on the RIA. Secondly, what I think there is missing in the process as it currently stands is the fact that the registrars are actually doing a sort of translation, if you wish, of the RIR into contracts, into local contracts. And it could well be that the problem happens to be in this translation phase. It could be that if there is a court decision and a certain need for a change of the contract between registrar and registrants, that doesn't actually impact the RIA necessarily. I mean, it only gets to an issue at the moment that it is unequivocally clear, and I guess it can only be clear to the registrar in this case, that the result, that the court case is the result in the deed of the provision of the RAA. So I think we have put this out in a diagram because you will see in the diagram that if ICANN staff gets involved in any of these issues, which are more on the right of the diagram, suddenly ICANN staff gets into these relationships with that, which are there. I've put in, or we have put in also, this notion of claimant, which comes from Steve, which we haven't quite understood yet what he means with that, but you'll see that ICANN staff gets involved somewhere in that relationship, and the question arises, is that the way that we see this process, this procedure function or not? So I think, in summary, we've been trying to focus in a bit on the fact that although the target of the procedure seems to be a possible conflict between RAA and between ICANN and registrar and or registry, or legal obligations, say, between registry, registrar on one side and ICANN on the other, it isn't clear to us that actually any government action is on that. We have the sense that is much more on a different relationship. And we thought it may be useful to have somewhat of a discussion on that to make sure that we're all talking about the same thing and what the implications is of the involvement of ICANN staff in any of these things.
I'd like to comment on that if I could. This is Milton.
Sure. Milton, anyone else want to be in the queue?
Possibly, but I just have a question.
You can go first if you want, if it's just a clarification question for, is it for Paul? Hello?
Why don't you just go ahead, Milton?
Okay. That was Paul speaking, was it not?
Yes,
the sound quality is so bad I can't tell. I think that you bring up an important distinction between the registrar-registrant contract, particularly when it's been translated into a foreign language, and the RAA. However, it's pretty clear to me that what is going to happen if the registrar is threatened by any of these kinds of activities is that they're going to say, we have to do this because of the RAA. In other words, if the contract is challenged by a claimant of some kind, and the initial debate focuses on the contract between registrar and registrant, the natural and almost inevitable thing for the registrar to do is to say, well, we don't have any choice. Our RAA contract with ICANN, which makes it possible for us to do business, is requiring certain kinds of disclosure of the who is data. So eventually, I think it would come back down to the RAA. That's all.
Thanks, Milton. And my impression, just to declare, to, I guess, to, sorry, Marilyn, I'll turn it over to you in one second, is that my impression is the procedure is supposed to apply when the registrar has made a conclusion that whatever action is being brought to them is a result of a requirement in the accreditation agreement, regardless of whether or not the action is directly, you know, it may be, you're right, Paul, that the regulator or the law enforcement agency doesn't come to the registrar and says this provision in your accreditation agreement is violative of our privacy laws, but they may come and they may say this procedure in your terms of services with your registrants has a problem, and the registrar will immediately realize that the only reason that's in there is because they have a similar obligation in the accreditation agreement. That's the point at which they would engage ICANN in the process.
Right, Jordan, and just to put it in the other way, if indeed all that happens is that they challenge the local contract and it doesn't in any way involve the RAA, then there's no problem. We don't have to worry about it at all. The procedure doesn't get invoked. So I know, you know, there's an escape valve there.
Okay, Marilyn, did you have a question?
I think no. I Actually, you kind of answered my question by your question.
Okay. Any other questions or comments about Paul's point?
Yeah, just one slight remark is that and the draft we have sent out in step two consultation, there's already that written that general counsel don't need to take any further action if it doesn't have anything to do with the RA. So, I mean, that's the answer to that question already.
Thanks, Tom. Paul, is that helpful in clarifying the intent of the procedure?
Yeah, I think it is somewhat clarifying. I just want to be careful that we understand who is getting involved in what, because my impression from the current text is that it seems that the RAA, for example, is on the stand in terms of having a problem, which is in a way true. I mean, what we're looking at in the procedure is the legal obligations of the registrar and registries on the one side with ICANN on the other side, whereas the actual judicial action, if I can express it in that way, is actually on probably on something else. And the question arises whether we have sufficiently untangled and unpacked these things, because the procedure currently gives an impression that ICANN, certainly in step two, gets involved in these actions and begins consultations and all sorts of things, whereas, you know, it isn't clear to me that the court is actually, if there would be a court involved, that the court would be interested in this per se, because for them this is, you know, a matter hidden behind, let's say, the registrar. And obviously for the registrar it is of importance, but I mean, what we in the staff have as an additional issue, and we have recently come to realize that, is that we don't necessarily see the translation, and I'm not talking only linguistic, I'm talking about, you know, the sort of implementation of the RAR into local contracts and in that sort of legal translation process, so to speak. All sorts of things can happen, including the registrar could have made a mistake, and this. So, you know, there are actually three elements in there, and that's the RAA, the local contract in whatever language, in whatever dimensions that linguistics brings to that, plus the legal change in that, as well as the actual translation of the registrar in question from the one to the other. And I think it is just important to make clear that we all understand what those steps are and who is involved in what, and that we unpack it in a sufficient measure to see, you know, what the resulting actions is and who gets involved with what on all of these things, because it otherwise gets pretty muddled. That was my only attempt, was to try and clarify with you exactly, you know, what is happening.
Thanks, Paul. And keeping that in mind, it may be, without trying to draft on the phone, it may be useful to look at the language to see if it could be made clear that that, you know, ICANN certainly should have the prerogative to come to the conclusion that this is not a requirement of the RAA, and the registrar is incorrect in asserting that that the conflict is caused by a requirement made by the RAA.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Okay,
Jordan, would you put me in the queue, please?
Certainly, yeah. Ken. And then any other? Go ahead. Does anyone else want to be in the queue right now?
I'd like to be in the queue. It's Paul.
Ken, then Paul. Anyone else? Okay, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, Paul referred to courts. I'm concerned about the possibility that in certain countries, especially in the European Union and in the UK, in particular, someone could file a complaint with a regulatory agency or with a government agency, arguing that the display of the information in there, who is by a registrar, is in direct
contravention to the privacy requirements of that specific country. It would seem to me at that point in time the agency is not going to address the registrar only with respect to the specific complaint filed by the registrant, but is going to go back to the registrar or to a registry, hypothetically even, and say that we need to take a look at your policies here, and if they decide that the registrar is, in their opinion, in violation of their privacy laws, the registrar's logical defense for that or would be, in fact, that there is a requirement on them, that's been put on them by someone to display this data. I don't think they're going to end up just dealing with the sanctity of a contract between the registrar and the registrant, but they're going to approach it much more logically from their standpoint on a as a policy issue. And I think we need to at least be prepared to deal with that.
Thanks, Ken. Paul? I just need a clarification on what Paul said before Ken. So in the RAA, 3.7.7.3 talks about how registrars could license the name. And so, and that allows us to do services like ENAMS, ID Protect, and GoDaddy's domains by proxy and so on. So what I don't understand, I think, is how can there possibly be a conflict then with a national law that would, for example, prohibit some registrar in some other country from registering names when they could always put the names on ID Protect? If they choose not to do that, do they get to get a special exemption from ICANN just because they choose not to do that?
Well, if I could respond to that, or maybe somebody from Europe, but the point is, Paul, the many countries consider protection of this kind of data to be a legally mandated right, and certain forms of handling the data to be illegal. And it doesn't, you know, the idea that you can buy more protection from a registrar doesn't enter into this consideration at all. If, in fact, you are displaying this potentially sensitive contact data indiscriminately across the Internet, and you're allowing various kinds of bulk access to that data, whether or not it's privacy protected, this is what some of the people think is conflicting with existing laws. So it's still a problem, regardless of the option of buying additional privacy protection.
Let's say, you know, you didn't have to buy it. It could just be free. I don't understand why, you know, whoever, Schlund, can't in Germany, but every time somebody registers a name, it's automatically on whatever they want to call it, their ID Protect, and then the output is, you know, Schlund Holding Company number 2, and that's what's displayed all over the Internet, not the person's personal information.
So, Paul, this is, I think that would be a situation like that where there was a reasonable alternative that could be developed is exactly what the procedure is intended to sort of bring out. If there's a way to resolve the conflict without changing or without a sort of variance to the accreditation agreement, then the registrar, I think, would be expected to do that.
Yeah, that's...
Can I, Jordan, have a comment on that?
Yeah, Jordan, this is David. I'd like to make a comment, too.
Okay, Tom, David, anyone else? Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Okay, thanks. I guess the main presumption we had as we were building that is that we don't really know what regulation might come up. I mean, there's a lot of talk about what we could do or what we couldn't do in the EU under the data privacy regulation we have, and there are a lot of people having a lot of different views on that.
So we don't really know exactly what would happen. And for instance, in Germany, we have a problem that we have more than one data privacy commissioner, and it all depends on which state you live in, and each of these people might have another view. So just to talk a little bit about that there's not a general view we can apply. So we don't really know in the future what will come up, especially I want to mention that law can change when certain legislation can start to be more privacy aware or take away privacy through it.
So the whole process is more or less to, it's designed to be able to deal with issues once they arise and not to preclude any resolution to it. It's just the process for registrars to be able to resolve it with ICANN stuff without kind of endangering the accreditation first.
Thanks, Tom. David?
Yeah, just quickly to add to what Milton said, there is a right to privacy pursuant to the EU Privacy Directive, but also it's important to note, without getting too much into a debate on privacy, that there are exceptions to that right that also need to be considered when you're determining whether or not information in the WHOIS database is or is not subject to the directive.
Great, thanks. So let me ask once again to return to sort of the narrow focus that I'm trying to get, at least in this first stage of this conversation. Does anyone else have any comments relating to specific changes or reaction to Steve's new version of the proposed procedure? If not, we can certainly continue to work.
I have a question, Paul. Again,
yeah, go ahead, Paul. Anyone else?
What was the question again?
Do people have specific reactions or proposed changes or to Steve's new draft?
Well, I sent a list of I think five specific changes.
Correct. So we could decide if you have any of those you want to highlight. This would be a good time, or we could continue to work those on the list.
Okay, I would wait. I guess Paul is in the queue.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul, then Milton.
One real simple one, on step two, letter III, I think the if should be an is. My second one is not so simple. I read it. It doesn't make mention of, let's say there were two registrars, both in Germany. The first one comes and has an output from ICANN. The analysis and recommendation, step three. Let's say ICANN outputs something. Does the second one have to come in and go through the whole procedure again, or do they just get that output as well? And how does that apply to other ones that aren't in that country?
Yeah, Paul, I don't think the procedure addresses that right now. So I don't think there's an answer to your question.
But then, by default, the second one has to do the whole procedure again.
Yeah, I mean, it would be up to the staff may decide to sort of streamline the process the second time, but yeah, there's no contingency for automatically applying it.
John, Paul,
yeah? Yeah. Paul, and then I'll get to you in just a moment, Milton. Go ahead,
yeah,
Paul.
Just to answer to this, my assumption is if there is action by an agency or a court or a regulator or whatever, and it applies to one particular registry or registrar operating on the market of a particular country, then my assumption is that if it is established that the RIA is the cause of the problem, then it seems to me fairly logical that this would cause a problem for all registries or registrars operating on the market of that particular country. And in the EU, this could well mean that this is a problem for all EU countries plus all EFTA countries. So this could subsequently mean, obviously, that, if we have seriously followed all this and there has been indeed a confirmation that this is the case, et cetera, et cetera, that we are in for serious changes with many operators, depending on the country this is in and the case this and the results of the case. So I think we will, certainly from the staff side, want to look at that, because I don't see it as realistic that we subsequently would go through the same thing for everybody.
Can I, it's Marilyn, can I get in the queue?
Yeah, certainly.
Can you put me in as well, please, Jordan?
So I have Milton, Marilyn, Ross.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Milton.
Okay, I think, I think the main change that Steve made in his draft, and I hope we're discussing specific things now in the draft, is making it a recommendation. And I can see, you know, both sides of that question. It seemed like the staff would welcome a recommendation more than a policy. Although it seemed to me that their main concern with the policy was that they didn't want to have their activities completely straitjacketed or completely determined by something we gave to them. And I think that many in the GNSO would prefer to have this be a policy, that we are indeed making a policy. But a middle ground is that we can say that it's our policy to have a procedure for reconciliation of conflicts, but to make the specific procedure a recommendation. So that's one change that I proposed. The other clarification, and I've already seen some support for this on the list, is that we should make it clear that this is indeed a stopgap measure, that indeed if we do our job and reform who is access and data elements and policy issues completely, then the need for this probably could be eliminated entirely. And I think that whatever we adopt should contain some recognition of that fact. We'd like to see the appendices attached in order to document the existence of these conflicts with national laws. And then getting to specific wording changes, in line 10 of the first paragraph, I understand why Steve added, did he add, it's important that ICANN staff and board retain sufficient flexibility to respond to particular factual situations as they arise. I would support that. But he also added, and to fulfill their obligations to all elements of the ICANN community.
Okay, Daddy.
Hi, Daddy. And that, that struck me as a bit too broad of a wording, in the sense that I don't think staff should have the ability to determine which element of the ICANN community they're responding to on this particular issue. They need to take their guidance from the GNSO. So I'd like to see that specific language stricken. And then near the end, when we're talking about the criteria that would be used to disallow an exception, we would prefer to hold them to a very specific, clear guideline that was deleted in Steve's draft. Steve deleted the language, as a general rule, the general counsel shall not recommend any enforcement action against the registry or registrar unless it finds that enforcement action is necessary to preserve the operational stability, reliability, security, or global interoperability of the Internet's unique identifier systems. So that's how I'd like to see the document modified. If those changes were made, we could support it, and there may be some wiggle room on one or two of the others, which we could discuss.
Thanks, Milton. Marilyn?
Thanks. I am going to drop off in a few minutes, but I think David is on for the BC. I am at this point still inclined to think that this is better as a recommendation rather than consensus policy. I think Milton's idea of perhaps the idea of having a policy but the specifics being a recommendation to discuss that with my
Marilyn, we're sort of losing you here.
Sorry. I said I hadn't had a chance. I was of the opinion that this goes better as a recommendation than as a policy,
but I have not had a chance to consider Milton's kind of alternative suggestion of perhaps it would be a policy, but the specifics would be a recommendation. So since I haven't had a chance to talk with others from the BC, at this point I'm still inclined to think that this goes better as a recommendation in order to provide the needed flexibility. That's the primary comment that I have, other than I think we have to be a little bit cautious and make sure that whatever we attach as supporting documents, that we've had a chance to make sure that they are current or up-to-date, or note them in some way that would be appropriate of initial survey or initial information or first scan of information or something of that nature.
Yeah, thanks, Marilyn. And I think when we get to the point that we've agreed on the recommendations or constructing the report, I think we could address that particular topic. Ross?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I
can. Oh, okay, good. Sorry, I wasn't sure if I was on mute or not. I guess I've got a couple of questions. I'd echo the, I think it was Milton that had flagged it, regarding whether or not this was a short-term proposal or a long-term policy implementation. A short-term recommendation or a long-term policy implementation. If this is indeed a stopgap measure, I think it's mandatory that we flag that within this document and actually set some bounds around that. Whether that be a 1 year is short term, 6 months is short term, 5 years is short term, whatever we decide that is. Otherwise, it becomes policy unto itself and very difficult to deal with at a future point. Milton's proposal to kind of make it half policy, half advice is interesting. I'm not sure that, I guess some language around that would be useful. I'd certainly, without the benefit of that language, advocate that we move this forward as advice to the staff versus a policy recommendation to the council. But seeing that language would make it a lot easier for me to make a determination on that. One question I had about this document that isn't clear for me, though, is how within any given registrar operation or registry operation, we're supposed to deal with local variations on a global basis. And by that I mean in an instance where where a waiver is granted in, let's say, Canada because of Canadian privacy regulation, but that waiver is not granted under U.S. Regulation. Does that mean that within our respective operations, we're supposed to make that rights or that additional privacy available to just our Canadian customers? It's not clear what the intent there is. There any clarity I can get on that would be useful.
Yeah, Russ, I'm going to suggest that once again, that's something that actually is not considered by the current proposal, and I would guess that would be discussed as part of the process, whether the breadth of the whatever change was made, if any.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's not specifically addressed in the current document.
In terms of preference, it would certainly be my wish that whatever we do could be applied to all of my customers versus six of them. That just makes things a lot easier.
Okay, great. Anyone else have comments specifically related to the new text that Steve's proposed?
Yeah, I would like to have a take on it.
Tom, anyone else?
There's Pauline.
Yeah, I have a question too.
Okay, Paul, is that Maria?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I'm really short. I just want to kind of echo what Milton said in his first thing, that I think making it half-half might be a good idea, that we make a recommendation, a policy recommendation about that there should be an established process and on the other hand, make a recommendation about the process we would like to see and have that as advice issued to the council.
Great, thanks. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, my question pertains to the introduction by Steve of this notion of other claimant. I am not sure what exactly he has in mind with that. Are those governmental claimants or are those any other claimants? And from our perspective, in order to just oversee the scope of this, it would be useful to have some clarification on that. Maybe there are others on the call who know what Steve had in mind with it.
Yeah, I don't. If no one else does, we may have to ask Steve by email, Paul.
Okay.
Jordan, Nicholas here. Can I make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead, Nicholas. Is it related to this point? Or?
No, it's related to Paul's question.
Okay.
The answer here, because we would have to ask Steve. But I have the feeling that the reason why, on the one hand, there's the court agency possibility and the claimant possibility is that looking at the European situation, basically, if a problem arises, it would probably be triggered by a law enforcement authority or a data protection authority that would bring the issue, and this is probably the kind of scenario one could imagine in a European context. Whereas maybe in a U.S. context, you could also have the possibility of simply a private lawsuit being launched, and that would trigger the consultation. So I think we would have to put the question to Steve, but I would say that that's probably the reason why there's this distinction.
Thanks, Nicholas. And does anyone else have any insight into this, something we've discussed before? I don't remember discussing this. Okay, so Paul, we'll have to try that by email.
Okay.
Maria?
Yeah, Jordan, actually, I was going to ask a question Paul just asked, so I'm fine, thanks.
Okay. So if that's all of our questions related to Steve's text, I think there are a couple action items that I'd like to briefly propose. With regards to the text. One is, it seems like we've identified a couple of other issues here that people may like to have addressed via the text. For example, Ross is concerned that it be applied to all customers, or perhaps Paul Stafur is concerned that maybe there should be applicability to other registrars that are similarly situated. I would encourage those that have similar concerns to perhaps draft some the appropriate text to address those concerns and submit it to the list. Similarly, Milton and or Tom Keller, you guys, it might be helpful for you to draft up how you think this might be expressed to be a policy/recommendation hybrid as opposed to a pure recommendation or pure policy.
I just sent a sentence to the list.
Okay. So you're already ahead of me, Milton. Thank you. And with that in mind, I'm going to move on to a brief conversation, I hope, of just the more general sort of work underlying this work item.
Jordan?
Yeah, oh, go,
sorry,
Marilyn.
Sorry, Maria.
Sorry,
just one point before we move on. And I should have mentioned that John Jeffrey is taking a look at this, and he will be able to get back to us also. Just he wants to look into some of the legal aspects of it as well. We can input those.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Maria. And if people do see questions, John has agreed that if we have specific questions for him, he'd be available on a call a week from today. So if people do have specific questions I think need to be addressed to the General Counsel, send them to the list, and Maria can arrange to have him be available. Okay, moving on then, I'm willing to open the floor briefly to a general discussion of this work item, its applicability to our terms of reference and or other approaches that might be taken that are considered to be superior, inferior, various other approaches, to echo some of the conversation that's been going on the list. Does anyone want to speak to that at this time? Or are we all happy with the dialogue on the list?
Well, you know, I'll say it, Jordan. I don't get the sense that we're allocating our time to the most useful outcome. You know, I think as a short-term measure, you might be able to convince me that this is a useful exercise, but, you know, I don't see issues like this coming up every day. I don't see anything that would indicate to me that this work is anything but dealing with boundary cases. So in the sense that, you know, we can either deal with, you know, we can kind of pander to the notion that we're never going to have privacy for registrants and come up with an exception-based thing like this and call our work done, or we can actually focus on the big rocks and actually move the privacy ball down the field. You know, again, as a short-term measure, it may not be that this is mutually exclusive goals, but, you know, I just don't get the sense that we're making a wisest investment at this time.
I'd like to respond to that if I could. This
yeah, sure. Milton, anyone else want to be in the queue on this?
Yes, I do.
Tom, Keller, anyone else?
Sure, Wendy.
Wendy. Okay, go ahead, Milton.
Yeah, I think, Ross, those of us who support this measure would be happy to abandon it if we thought that progress on even a modest reform like tiered access was imminent. We don't believe that, frankly. We think that it will be another two-year struggle. I think you may be understating the degree to which this is a serious legal risk to some registrars, and it might be a mistake for us to sit around and wait for legal lightning to strike and then sort of, you know, close the barn door, to mix metaphors in an awful way. You know, I really would not rule out in the near term, meaning in the next 6 to 8 months, some kind of a lawsuit deliberately designed to test the applicability of privacy protections to ICANN's regulatory regime. I think it could happen in the United States. There might be some legal grounds for it, not only in Europe. And I think it's just a question of, you know, who really cares enough to gather up the requisite resources to and the willpower to go after somebody. And I think if you don't have a procedure like this in place fairly quickly, that there's a real risk to some of the registrars out there. Now, obviously, the registrars should be more worried about those risks than I am. Certainly, we totally agree with you that the only reason this is necessary is because we haven't done the right thing to begin with. And so I don't want to step on those aspects of your comments at all. It's just that I really, having, like you, Ross, being a veteran of 2 or 3 years of, you know, wrangling over who is, I just don't see any immediate chance of major progress.
Thanks, Milton. Tom?
Thanks. Well, my comment would be that thought that it might only be something to deal with boundary cases, which might not even happen in the future, which I seriously doubt is, it's still worthwhile having a procedure to have a certain, how do you want to say it, predictability for the registrars who might encounter such a situation. Because the situation we have right now, if, for example, my data privacy commissioner would come up to me and tell me to take out the email addresses we have, I wouldn't really know what to do. And for me, it would be, or for my company, it would be an ease to know that there's a process we can rely on, just to say that. Another thing would be more like a historic remark. I mean, we're talking about that for the last 2.5 years, and it has been initially started with Task Quest 2, and we designed a process on how to deal with that because we felt after observing the privacy laws, or at least certain privacy laws of certain countries, that there might be a chance. And then it passed on to the connector, to the combined task force 1 and 2, and that feeling was still there, and we still worked on that and made progress. And now we kind of combined task force 1, 2, and 3, and now the whole thing is started again. So that kind of makes me, a little bit impatient because I have the feeling that we're not really making any progress on things that already could be done. I mean, we were close to recommendation in Task Force 2, then we were close to recommendation to combine Task Force 1 and 2, and now we have to go all over the whole thing again and make another round of iterations, and that kind of sad. And that's my historical remark to it.
Thanks, Tom. Wendy?
Sure. Yes, thanks to both Tom and Malcolm. Said a lot of the things that I had to say. Really, we need a stopgap because these procedures are so painfully slow. I think it was 3 years ago that we were talking about who is accuracy, and we were promised that we would get the privacy protections shortly to replace the pseudonymous contacts that had been a way to achieve privacy. 3 years later, we haven't gotten anything for the registrant to gain greater privacy, and nothing from ICANN, at least. And so for the registrars who are facing questions of how do they deal with national laws requiring them to give registrants more privacy options, I think it's important that we give them a procedure at this point. And absolutely, I would love to conclude this and to conclude something more meaningful for the substance of privacy of every registrant, no matter where he or she was located and no matter which registrar he or she used. So that's all.
Thanks, Wendy. So it does seem, I'll make two brief comments. One is that, I personally would like to see us make progress on both of our other work items that may make this work item relatively moot. As I suggested last week, I think that there's some relatively useful underlying debate here in terms of the focus of the task force, and I think that certainly those of you that are counselors could take this up in the new terms of reference for the task force. Those of you that are not, I would encourage to engage in dialogue with the representatives from your constituency. But to a certain extent, the scope of work of the task force will be determined by the new terms of reference, not by a unilateral decision that we're going to make within the task force. But having said that, we do have some time scheduled over the next couple of weeks to try to have some substantive dialogue around both tiered access and accuracy. And I'd like to see, if we can make some progress there. To Ross's point, it may sort of moot out the need for a lot of ongoing work here. But I think, it sounds like Milton and Tom and Wendy, at least, would probably want to see some serious progress there before they decide that this wasn't a useful endeavor. So I'd encourage people to. One of our big problems that we've had thus far, and the other topics, has been simply a lack of concrete proposals. And certainly encourage people to do thinking around that and submit any concrete ideas to ground some of our discussions over the next couple of weeks. And forward them to the list. Other points on this topic? Okay, well, I'm going to move to wrap up the call then. The one thing that we are missing, I guess, is a sequencing of the next two calls, whether the first one relates to accuracy or to tiered access. Based on the call, on the discussion we had on the last call, I'm probably leaning towards accuracy as the first topic, but I wonder if anyone's developed stronger thoughts on this over the intervening week.
I'm sorry, Jordan, I didn't understand the question.
So we have the next 2 weeks we're scheduled to discuss accuracy and tiered access, but no particular order. And I'm just, I guess, asking again if anyone has particularly strong thoughts as to
oh, I see.
The order.
Okay. Sorry.
Well, one thing that makes me wonder is why we're not finishing off one of the things we're just working on. I mean, working on the list is very useful, but I could imagine that if Milton and I and maybe others are coming up with newer substitute language to the local issue problem, you know, that might be very appropriate to talk about that on our next call instead of going on and delaying that for another month. So we might even be able to have a recommendation for the next ICANN board meeting.
Yeah, well, Tom, to a certain extent, what I'm trying to, we don't have it, we're sort of acting in limbo without a charter at this time. And to a certain extent, what I'm trying to accomplish is to see if we can't move the needle in terms of the substance of the dialogue on any of these topics. So I think we've had some good conversation today, and we have some ways to continue to develop these recommendations. And I'd really like to see whether we can't do the same thing on the other two topics, so that when we get a new charter, if it turns out that one or more of these are in or out, that we'll be well prepared to engage in that conversation. Okay, so I guess lacking an outcry, I think we will schedule next week to discuss the accuracy topic, starting with the Bruce's summary of the Cape Town dialogue as a starting point for that. I'll redistribute that to the list over the next couple of days for people to review, so that we can use that as a framework. And as I suggested, I think if people have, the more concrete ideas we have going into that call, the more useful it will be, and the more likely it is that we'll be able to come up with some useful progress towards being able to develop actionable recommendations. And I'd encourage anyone that has an interest in the accuracy topic to, hopefully that's all of us, to think whether there are specific proposals they could put forward. With that in mind, the other thing that you should all be looking for is that I will be pulling the list for the preferred and workable time slots for the call starting next week, which will change. So hopefully we'll resolve that in the next couple of days. Any other business before we wrap up? Okay, thanks everyone. We will be continuing to work this issue on list, and we'll talk next week to discuss the accuracy topic.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jordan.
Bye.